All right. Last class, we were studying chapter 2. We didn't quite complete the lesson. We were looking at faith and works. And we were on page 12. We had finished answering the question, was Abraham justified before or after he offered Isaac on the altar? Was he justified by works or by faith? And we have, we're looking at James 2, verse 21, and then comparing that in some passages in Genesis and Romans. And we were seeing that in some instances where we're trying to harmonize these, that we see where he said, he's saved by faith. He's saved by faith. He believed and he was saved by faith. And in James, he said, oh, he was saved by the works that he did. And of course, as we discussed, it was, when was he justified? He was justified by his belief before any works. But he was also justified by his works, illustrating his continued belief and his continued faith. It's a little bit of both. And discuss that because there are people in the world who would disagree with us. They would say, oh, look right here, that verse right here says, he was saved by faith only. So therefore, works are excluded and are not required. And I think we've looked at that and shown that it isn't specifically the case. Continuing in that line of thought, I ask you to look at these next following passages and define the term works. We have, as we've seen in James, verses 20 through 24. But do you want to know, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead? Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? Do you see that faith was working together with his works, and by works faith was made perfect? And the scripture was fulfilled which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. You see then that a man is justified by works and not by faith only. So how would you define the works as given in this context?
Actions resulting from faith.
Yes, actions resulting from faith. Actions that are produced from faith.
They're not works.
Faith working together with works.
Sorry?
Faith working together with works.
Yes, that's correct. Faith working with works. Right?
I'm simply going to qualify. The works here is not to justify. They're not earning salvation. And that's where our friends struggle. And we should be very clear that there is an aspect of that they're right. We never work our way to salvation from a standpoint of earning. So this is a work, just as others have said. It's coupled with faith. You can't have faith without it. There's a type of faith. But the faith here is a faith/works system.
Yes. Yeah, these works we're defining here that James is talking about are not, pegs on a board, and I fill up the quota, boom, 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 this work, that work, and I'm saved. It's exactly as we've all said, it's the faith, the works show our faith, but it's still faith that saves. And of course, can you have faith without works? No. If you have belief, you're going to have works. They're going to behavior that comes out of that faith that illustrates your faith. If not, your faith is suspect. If we look at over in Romans chapter 4, where Paul is speaking of works and of faith. Romans 4, beginning verse 4 and 5. Now to him who works, the wages are not counted as grace, but as debt. But to him who does not work, but believes on him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is accounted for righteousness. And also, skip over to chapter 9 and 32 of Romans. I'll do a little preemptive read here, beginning verse 30. What shall we say then, that Gentiles who did not pursue righteousness have attained the righteousness, even the righteousness of faith? But Israel, pursuing the law of righteousness, has not attained the law of righteousness? Why? Because they did not seek it by faith, but as it were, by the works of the law, for they stumbled as the stumbling stone. And of course, this is looking at the works here as Paul defines it. We see he's saying it's not works, it's faith, which, as some people say, you know, contradicts with James. how is Paul using the works here? The term works.
This is the works of the law, Moses. The book of Romans, it's grace versus the law of Moses. It's faith, you know, it's saved by grace through the new covenant, the old law. So the works here in Romans is the works under the old law, or maybe the works in James may just be, you know, just obeying whatever the Lord says, you know, because these people were Christians. They weren't keeping the law, but they were just having faith but not doing, you know, not obeying what the new covenant had said. So either one, you know, the Israelites had faith. They couldn't keep the law perfectly, but they did. You know, God looked at the faith of the Israelites. They had to keep it by faith, but you know, it's a different work in Romans than it is in James.
Yeah, and I just to point out there a little extra. Yes, the good Jews had faith, and they performed the works they were commanded to do. Mm-hmm. We do see in the prophets where a lot of people were still performing the works, and yet had no faith. And, you know, committing the sacrifices. And God said, I don't want your sacrifices, because they had no faith behind it. Why were they still doing all that stuff? Because, you know, they get bound in tradition. They get off that mindset of, I have works only, and that'll get me there. Is there a question over here?
Just to go with what Ms. Ottersbeck was saying, the verse that clarifies what works are being talked about in Romans is Romans 3, verse 28. For we maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from works of the law. And then from then on out, the works are in reference to that idea, the works of the law. And that law he's talking about there is the old law, Mosaic law.
Yes.
So, you know, when we're trying to talk to somebody about how faith is apart from works, and we go to these verses, works of the law, that's a good verse to know, like, you know, on hand, chapter 3, verse 28, works of the law.
Yes. And, of course, yeah, Romans is dealing with Jews and the old law. But is it not possible that someone could still fall into that same trap, you know, today without the works of the law? I just need works. And is it possible? Do people do that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people do that today. And I think we've seen here that people are continuing in works until one day they just stop and fall away. And you're like, well, what happened? They didn't all happen instantly. Their faith fell away first, but they are still... People can fake it, right? You still do things, and from the outside, it looks like it's still there.
I think when people say, oh, well, as long as, you know, you're a good person, you know, then God's not going to send you to hell and everything. And that's basically just, they think that just how you act, whether you believe in God or whether you worship or not, you know, just your works is going to save you.
Yeah, and that's another prevalent thought that people have is, the act of doing good and being nice, I don't do bad stuff, but I don't really trust in Jesus to save me, or I don't need to go to church and exhibit faith. I'm just good. And people believe that. Oh, well, he's all right. I had more comments back here. Someone, Rod?
So, when we try to explain this to our friends, and we move from James to Romans, they're going to say, wait a minute, time out, you're playing games because you're trying to make words fit different meanings in different places, which we are. We're not playing games, but that's what we're doing. I would suggest you stay in James first and say, do you think that the word belief means different things in different, has different connotations, different meanings? show them the verse about the devil's, the demon's belief. Is your belief any different than the demon's? Well, yeah, my belief, I do something. Now you got them. You say, so you understand belief has different meanings, and you believe that you do something because of your belief. You just described the faith of James, which is not the faith of Romans, or not the works of Romans, because you ever made a mistake? Well, yeah, I made a mistake. Okay. So your faith is not, your works are not perfect, but they are coupled with your faith. Back to James. So, I mean, if you don't try to get them to believe it on the way, and you go back to Romans, I think they'll stumble over that, because they'll say, you're making the passages mean what you want them to mean. Well, let them find the definition of those words in their own mind. I think it'll be a lot more helpful if you try it that way. Just practical.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think James can stand alone.
Yes,
and
he can.
To get the point across. It's all there. It's understandable. But yeah, people do fall back to Romans and go, well, no, look it over here. And to understand the difference between the two. Right?
There's three in my mind at the moment. There's three New Testament accounts. Talking about just the New Testament. They talk about the works and the faith of Abraham. Here in James, in Hebrews 11, and in Romans. All three of these can stand alone. Romans can stand alone. You don't even have to look at Romans to prove what James is talking about. You can do that within the book of Romans all by itself.
Yes.
For instance, if you look in the fourth chapter, and this is in the midst of the discussion that we're having about faith versus work. At the very beginning of the fourth chapter, this would be the denominational argument in the beginning verses. But notice what happens when you move over, does it say beginning around verse 18? And it's talking about Abraham. In hope, Abraham believed against hope that he should become the father of many nations, as he had been told, so shall your offspring be. Now notice, he did not weaken in faith when he considered his own body was as good as dead, since he was about 100 years old, or he considered the barrenness of Sarah's womb. No distrust made him waver concerning the promise of God. Now what's this idea of wavering? Wavering has to do with carrying through, going on with what God has told you to do. It's an action reference. Okay, so these verses through here are talking action. In verse 21, fully convinced that God was able to do what he promised, announced at verse 22. That is why his faith was counted to him as righteousness. If he had wavered in verse 20, then he wouldn't have carried through. He wouldn't have believed either. That's true. But then he would not have carried through. So the idea that James is presenting here, I mean that Paul is presenting here, is that belief involves a carrying through on what you believe. And that's really the crux of the matter. If you believe, you carry through. If you don't believe, you don't carry through.
Yes.
He carried through. Because he carried through, then his faith was counted to him as righteousness. So Romans proves it. You don't even need James to prove it.
Oh, correct.
They stand alone.
And we know Paul doesn't believe what people are trying to say. He believes that he doesn't need works, or no one needs works in faith. As you rightly pointed out, and I also was going to look at verse 12, we know Paul believes that works are needed with faith. But he's, you know, the difference between the two is the two writers are pointing out a specific problem that's existing in with these different people. And he's focusing on that problem, trying to set them straight. You know, and then we've got two different sides going on here. One, some are focused on, you know, works, and the other one, they're focused on faith and they don't want to work. And of course the middle ground is where they need to be, faith and works. So yeah, the works that Paul's particularly, you know, speaking against are the works that some believe earn reputation, that are not works that are not part of faith. They're not required. Faith that doesn't, faith of not requiring works. So, You know, they sought salvation through circumcision and the obeying of the law in this particular case. So as Mike pointed out, in Romans itself, we know what Paul believes. He believes the same thing James does. Looking at, in addition to what Mike has pointed out, also in verse 12, I was looking for the phrase which shows that as well. How do we know that Paul believes in works and faith?
Following the steps of the faith.
Yeah, he says, follow in the steps of faith. He's telling them, faith will save you, faith will save you. And then, yeah, beginning of verse 12 says, yeah, but you got to follow in faith. Mine says, walk in the footsteps of faith. That requires works, does it not? To walk in footsteps of faith. He's telling them to walk. And then, yeah, as Mike's shown us here in the 20-somethings of that same chapter, it's about not wavering, it's continuing in works in that faith. Continuing in faith, and that's works are going to be part of that. Of course, that also, you know, some people take, you know, even nowadays, that they take, oh, it's just works, as Lisa said, you know, oh, I'm just going to be good. Other people, as Jews, I guess, I follow in the works of Abraham. Some think, I'm baptized and that's it. Saved. It's a done deal. You know, no more required. Or anything else after is, you know, it doesn't change. It doesn't change what's now set in stone. I'm saved. And this would refute that, would it not?
It's kind of like a person saying, I'm married. This means I love my husband or my wife for the rest of my life. My wedding happened. You know, and then just never doing anything else for their wife or husband the rest of their life. It's not, I mean, anyone outside of that relationship could look at it and go, that is just silly and makes no sense.
Yeah.
You know, and I think when you start talking to people about faith and works, most people realize that if they have a real faith, there are going to be works that come out of that faith. I think that most people who are actually honest people, it makes sense, you know, and so just...
Yeah, it's just common sense when you're not trying to force a particular doctrine, isn't it? And I think everyone would agree with that statement. Like, oh, I got married, I love you, and that proves it for all time. You know, in a marriage, I love you, and now I can do whatever. And, of course, no one's going to, you know, believe that, you know, and say, well, oh, yeah, he loves his wife because he married her, but from now on, look how he treats her. Or, you know, or the other way. I don't want to be discriminatory. It can go both ways. It does. you know, yeah, it's, everyone realizes that because that just makes sense. And then you come to Scripture sometimes and you're like, no, but that's the doctrine I want to believe because that would be a lot easier. And then they find, you know, passages to try to prove it. So, any other comments? Good comments.
I think Jesus began when he was preaching the Sermon on the Mount. He said, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. But he does, the will of my Father. You know, you're asking for definitions in three verses down. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts upon them. But that's what Jesus calls faith, you know. And he wants you to not only know what truth is, but he wants you to do what truth is.
Yeah, that's right. Any other comments? Sorry, I thought you'd end up for a second. all right. Well, I think we all get it, and of course, now we need to, of course, apply that in our lives by continuing the faith, by continuing the work, not for the sake of salvation of works, but for this demonstration of our faith. So Romans, James chapter 3. Beginning on page 13. James moves in a different direction now, or slightly. Still some of the same thoughts, but dealing with a different matter. We spoke previously about, you know, subdividing the book And I know a lot of people came up this, at least some of this section is the dangers of the tongue or speech. So I asked you to look at, identify the number of times in the verses where you see the thought or words relating to tongue or whatnot. What did y'all come up with?
Eight?
Yeah. That's good. I've got lots of different words relating to the tongue besides just the tongue. Verse one, I went with the teachers, as teachers implies speaking. It would be a lot easier to get up here and teach y'all and not have to say anything. But then I don't think we could call that teaching, could we? And so inherent in the thought of a teacher is the thought of speech. Of course, in verse...
See, I didn't count that one, because we can be teachers by our actions. People can watch us.
So it's not an absolute.
Yeah, it's not absolute. But I think in this set of passages, I think that's the thought behind it. Okay. Is because, you know, letting on you become teachers... For we all stumble in many things, and if anyone does stumble in a word, he's a perfect man able to bridle his whole body. He's talking about, he's warning them as teachers to watch out with your tongue. You know, you need to control it. Yeah, in verse 2, I had...
What he says.
mine uses the term word. Do not stumble in a word, or what he says. Y'all have to give some to me. I almost started rolling through the list myself.
Okay, back to verse 1, because I want to make... let me make a comment here.
Yes.
So some conclude that this passage is primarily about teachers. I would say it's primarily about controlling the tongue. And oh, by the way, one of the most prominent ways we use our tongue is to teach. And so it has specific application to teachers. But... I mean, I guess I don't see the primary teaching here as to teachers. Some do, and you lose anything in that, because it's applicable to teachers. It's applicable to
everyone.
You want me to skip ahead to question D?
I'm sorry. Oh, never mind. I wasn't trying to get ahead. Sorry.
All right. Well, I agree with you, and we'll get there.
Hold that thought.
Yeah, hold that thought. Verse 5. Of course, the tongue is mentioned. You said the tongue is a little number.
Verse 6.
Just once.
Twice.
Yeah, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, my passage used the tongue there in both instances.
Eight.
Same as the tongue. Sorry.
Twice and eight.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Well, how does yours read?
I've got no man can tame the tongue for the first one, and the second one I've got it is an unruly evil.
Yep. Pronouns count.
Well, and also verse 5, when you talk about boasting, you boast great things. That's something that the tongue's doing. So
yeah, boasting is inherent in speech.
Well, and then also in 5, I saw like a small fire, kind of relating. You'll see how great a force is set aflame by such a small fire. I mean, that's a direct reference back to the tongue.
I think, yeah, I'd count that as sort of an effect of the tongue. It's what comes about from improper use. let's see, where were we? Nine. We've got more pronouns, and also the same idea. I use bless. You know, with our mouth we bless
and curse.
And so the you get the pronouns and the bless and the curse are actions as performed with the tongue. And so throughout this passage we've seen, and of course if you want to use four, you also get the horse's mouth. But that's as it's relating back. We see all these different terms here. You know, we talked about the bless, the curse, the tongue, the word, and says. And so I think it's all pretty understood what the tongue represents in this passage, doesn't it? What do we say the tongue represents here? It's not just, what is a tongue? The tongue is a noun, right? It is a little bit of muscle in our mouth.
It's our speech.
Yeah, it represents our speech. It's
our tongue can give us some trouble.
Yes, it can.
It's a tool that can be used for good or, in this case, a lot of evil.
Yep. It's, by using the word tongue, it's representing speech and language through its association with the fact that you use your tongue to perform language, you know, form it.
In Proverbs 10, and also in other Proverbs, it talks about the tongue betrays the thoughts and the intents of the heart. And so it's just more than, you know, a word. It really betrays.
And you express who you are with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Out of the man, from the tongue, as Jesus said, you know, what defiles a man comes from within. Of course, that's how we express evil intents and desires. And of course, we can use it for good as well. I was going to say just one thought that, you know, that the idea that representation, as it's associated with another thing, is metonymy. And of course, we all understand it. We read these passages and we get it. The tongue isn't talking about, like I said, it's talking about speech. And every time we see the word tongue, just as we say, if we're in, you know, the rulers, you read old tiny stuff. You say, oh, they obey the crown and they follow the crown. What is a crown? It's just another noun. It's a piece of metal that someone puts on someone's head. It's the idea of as he associates the person who wears the crown and his commands of the king. So we get that. And before we get to Rod's a bit about who this particular passage was focused on or intended for.
I'm over it.
Are you over it? We were going to discuss it because I got it here. But I want to look at verses 3 through 5. What was James's intent in, what was he trying to, message was he trying to convey with the comparison between the tongue and then between the bit and a bridle and the rudder of a boat?
Did you do B?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the what the tongue represents.
Oh, that's what you were.
It's a small thing, but
because I have control, a lack of.
I'm sorry?
I missed that. It says, what does the tongue represent? Not the control or lack of. And that's having to do, it is speech, but.
Yeah, I think.
But I think they were talking about how you use it.
Yeah. Well, we'll get there. Yeah, we're certainly the tongue is for speech. Mm-hmm. We can either control it, or you can lose control of it.
I'm just saying a bit is a small thing and a rudder is a small thing compared to the whole boat, but it drives it, moves it, directs it.
Yeah, that's right. The bit of a bridle, just a little piece of metal you put in the horse's mouth, and with that, you can steer and control the horse. You know, and the same thing of the rudder, in size-wise, usually, you know, I guess it depends on how big you build your boat. But there's some really big boats out there, and they have small rudders. And if that vessel, they measure vessels now in tons upon tons. I was on a boat, I think it was 400-something tons. They're big. They're really big, and they get even bigger than ones I've seen floating around out there. And they're moved about on the ocean by a small rudder. And so this one small thing can have exercised great power, great control, great influence. And likewise, in between, you know, the boats and the horse. The tongue can direct us, can control us, can influence things, exercise a lot of influence. And, of course, it's how we control it, how we use it, what kind of influence it exercises, isn't it? As we mentioned, you know, it can cause a whole storm of evil, but with it, of course, it can also be used for good.
It's the tongue within itself is not the problem, it's the way we use the tongue.
That's correct. It's the thoughts we have, which we express.
We do with the tongue.
That's right, Jim. So on D, I asked us, or asked y'all, to whom this section was specifically written, and then what, also in correlation to that, what warning is given concerning the tongue. And in verses 1 through 2, I think we read previously, "My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body." And skip it down past the bit we just saw about the rudder and the bit in 6 through 12. "And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature." And this nature can also, my says, existence, sets on fire the whole course of existence, "and is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Or can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus no spring yields both salt water and fresh." And so, well, first question, I squeezed two questions into one. tricky. Who might assume this was focused on specifically?
Everyone that interacts with other people.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going with it generally.
Teachers.
Specifically.
Teachers.
I'd say the teachers, because, and as I was starting to discuss this earlier, you know, it begins this with, you know, warning the teachers. And, of course, you know, here's all these, the dangers of the tongue. I'm not going to say them because y'all got the same answer to the question in a minute. But there's dangers involved with the tongue, and the teachers, that's what they, a tool they use to teach. And yet, they can fall into the trap. And so they need to be careful. Now, of course, we say that specific, but does all these things we read, are they not true of anyone who's not a teacher? Yes, I mean, they're true of everyone, right? You know, we all have tongues, we all use speech to communicate, and it's a danger for all of us, whether you're a teacher or not. But of course, you know, it's especially so for a teacher who's going to be standing up and telling people things. And as a teacher, you're going to be, you know, some form of authority, I guess. And how much worse can problems can you cause by losing control of your tongue? So what are these dangers I've mentioned? What warnings were given?
Tongues of fire. You defile the whole body.
Yep. It's a fire. It can defile the whole body.
No man can tame it.
And it's restless. Sometimes it just gets away from us. It's never still. We have to be constantly watching, you know, and not let it get away from us, you know.
Yep, that falls back in line with that idea. That the idea it's not tameable. I think you can tame it, but as soon as you think you got it beat, you know, it riles back up on you. Horses, once they're broken, usually, I would say. They don't, you know, they're subjugated, they're submitted. But the tongue can still get you into trouble, especially when you're not careful and you think, I got this.
Can't you just see someone zero in on verse 8 and say, well, you know, it says no one can tame the tongue, so I might as well not even try. Of course, that means it's always a work in progress.
That's right.
And I probably should have mentioned this a few items up, but when we're thinking about the tongue, and we mentioned speech, it doesn't have to just be vocal speech. It can be the way we write to someone, like email or text or write a letter. So maybe we can just keep that in mind, that it's not just when we talk to someone face-to-face. It's just how we communicate, you know, speech in any form of exchange of ideas.
Yes, mm-hmm. Expression of thought or ideas. That's a good point, Josh, especially today. You know, back then, they could still write letters, and we've got all these other digital ways to express our thoughts, you know, and especially to sort of a like mass communication that, you know, you can send out an email and hit everybody. The old dangerous reply all on email. Whoa, get caught when you meant to talk to one person. And of course, texts do the same thing, and Facebook and that stuff kind of goes out to a whole host of people. And you can't really retract stuff easily once it's out there.
Also, I know I've experienced this, and people will say this, they aren't willing to say something face-to-face with someone. They'd feel more comfortable telling it to them like through an email or through a text. So it kind of takes away this, like, I guess, inhibition we may have to speak to someone face-to-face. We're more bold, or it's easier to be bold through writing or email. So I think that's another reason why it's important to bring that up. Like, this is about communication, and it's always demonstrating what's going on inside your heart, you know, who you are.
Yeah, the thoughts you have. And that's good, that comment about more bold, or I guess you could take that a lot of different ways. So sometimes maybe if you're saying something that's not nice, it's harder when you see their reaction, the pain. You see it right there. You know, it'll, you know, feel bad, but you don't have to see it. Maybe that's what some people do. They, you know, break up online or whatever, and say harsh things, cyber bullying, because you don't see the pain it inflicts, and it just goes out there.
And even saying it to someone else and not expecting that person to hear, but
yeah, that too. I guess that would be the secondary cycle, the someone forwarded the forward or whatever. yeah, and so it's the tools we have today make it even more careful of what we say and how we express, you know, ourselves, what thoughts we're putting out there. Don?
Well, and I've seen at times in working for large companies, it promoted, be a filter on what you, you know, filter what you write and put in an email, make it politically correct and all of this kind of stuff. So you have to do all of that. And everybody's very conscious about filtering their written communication. But their verbal communication, it's free for all. They have, you know, break rooms. And so I think sometimes even if we need to make sure that we have a filter, like he was saying, on all of our communications, even our thoughts. We have to filter what we think. We have to filter, because there's a lot of times, you know, as little kids, if they think it, they've said it. It's coming straight out of their mouth. And teaching them while they're young, it's like, okay, we need to reword how we say things. And so when we're older, it's just a continuous habit to get them in a mindset to filter everything that they think and say and write.
And you made me think of something else. Is you talk about filtering what we say. Yeah, we need to control what we say, but also wouldn't it take a step further in controlling what we're thinking, controlling our own attitude from where a lot of this stems from? You know, because if we can work on that as well, we're going to be better situated to control our tongue and to do what's right. Mike?
Back to the first part of the chapter and the idea of teachers. You can't deny that it begins with teaching. And you can't deny that it's addressing teachers. Because in the second part of the verse it says, you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. Now there is a whole lesson within itself. The fact that God is going to hold those who teach to some standard that is more strict than those who do not teach. Now, perhaps there's a way in which some of the people he's writing to were who were teachers that, you know, this would have a particular meaning to. But, and you could look in verse 2, it says, for we all, and read out the English version, for we all stumble. You could read that, for we who are teachers all stumble. You could read that. But when you get down to verse 8, but no human being can tame the tongue. And I don't know what your these other versions say. Mine says human being.
No one.
But it's opened up to outside of teachers.
Yeah.
So perhaps even from verse 2, it's opened to outside of teachers. So it certainly has universal application. And I think the writer himself brings that out.
Yes.
But there is an application specifically to teachers. And it's something that teachers have to be cognizant of because it's going to vary the way God looks at you on the day of judgment.
That's correct. That's hopefully what I was getting at is you're exactly right. This is all the warnings, all this, you know, what he's telling here to be careful. It applies to all of us, to all men. And like I said, but it's specifically, you know, doubly so important to teachers. They're going to receive a stricter judgment. I think also part of this is when you look at that first verse, it says, let not many of you become teachers. You can break that out into a lot of different things. I wasn't going to, you know, I didn't put anything on the papers I gave you, the lesson, because I didn't want to fall into it too much, but I think it might be some form of, you know, the Jews, a lot of them want to become teachers. They like the chief seats and that sort of thing, the authority that comes with that position to be called rabbi. And here, I think that one of the warning is against teachers, not let many of you become teachers. And he talks about the dangers of the tongue and all this, showing the, not that he doesn't want more teachers, that not many of you are qualified to be teachers, due to these dangers, due to this, you know, the exercise of this control, you need to be controlled. I think that's where he was angling for. But I won't get into that too much. Do you have more comment?
Well, it's along the line idea of what you're saying, and it's a idea again on this judgment. It's a lesser idea than God judging. And it goes back to, for instance, what Jesus said to the Pharisees, do as they say, not as they do. And it is common between us. You're up here teaching us. Yet if we hear you talk in ways that you shouldn't talk, we as the students make a judgment. You know, that if somebody else in the class has appeared and made that same statement as you did, we might not think less about it because they're not the teacher, but you're the teacher. So we also hold you to a higher standard. Yeah. Because you're teaching.
Thank you for that. Thank you, everybody. Good comments.
So if this gets real specific on teachers, it's the only part of James. It really gets into and now I'm talking about a subset of Christianity. Everything else from 1 through 5 is applicable to everybody.
It's okay.
And I think this is applicable to everyone too, but I think he's pointing out that this is applies to all of you. This is doubly applied to you, teacher.
It does. And I think some people say this is a section on teaching.
Oh, they say it's only to teachers?
Well, because that's the first verse in the section.
I wouldn't
go
that far,
well, yeah. That was the point.
Okay, question. Are we all supposed to be teacher descriptions? Isn't that our duty?
That's why I've been saying being in class,
because it's going way out in left field. But we're all supposed to, so you can say the law, to teach others the word of God, right?
Yeah, we're supposed to be spreading the gospel.
So but whether we're up here doing it or just out there, like little kids watch you regardless of whether you're at, whether you're up here teaching or not, they're watching you and you're teaching them your habits and things, right?
Yeah, there's a whole other lesson on that. But I mean, you can find other scriptures that say, you know, we are not all prophets. We're not all apostles. We're not all teachers.
Yeah.
And you see, in a sense, but also you see some people that, you know, I mean, you know, there's judgment of where they are in their belief, and there's just judgment of some people have a certain character that may not be lead them to be effective teachers. But you know, people can teach by being an example without speaking to everyone
right.
as well. So I didn't want to get into it.
I know, that's why I didn't say anything.
Because, like, it's a little line, but I mean, at the same time, to be a teacher, you must be qualified as well, right?
True.
So, yeah, we should aspire to be teachers as it is in our ability. Thank you. Yeah, I got the lights.
We'll get it.
All right.